This is Notepad. My name is Ibrahim Sani. We're taping this interview at Permatasapura in the KLCC Business District. Joining us in the studio is none other than the author of The Apple and the Tree, Datin Paduka Marina Mahathir. Marina, thanks again for taking time to speak with us. This is a holiday season. Not many of us are in the office. But of course, elsewhere around the country, there's a lot of happenings, a lot of ongoings. And most importantly, not just about elections and all that, but a lot of book publishing. I've never seen anything come out at once. From Tun Mahathir's own book, to Roman Bose, to yours. Prof. Kamal Hassan, my old rector, that was published by MA Research. Fantastic book. I just khatam that book. And this is the second book that I khatam this week. And I think that is quite fascinating that I don't know how you guys planned it to publish at the same time. That's my first question. Did you guys have some sort of a code?
No, I mean, strategy? We all didn't know. I mean, I knew my dad was going to have a book. And he was supposed to come out before me, but I don't know why it was delayed. Luckily for me, people buy my book first. But no, there's an entirely commercial reason why books come out this time of year, because it's, you know, just before Christmas where people want to buy presents. And so, yeah, we're hoping to tap into the Christmas present market.
It's certainly working. I was at Kinokuniya very recently. It's just nonstop. And you know, while people shop around for other stuff, fiction, non-fiction, whatever, the political books and the, I guess, I wouldn't call this a political book.
Thank you.
Life story books are actually quite still a popular choice. Yeah, genre. And I think, you know, it started off with a few years ago. And of course, Tommy Thomas's book actually caused a bit of a storm, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And that sort of like paved the way for more books such as this. So the first question is, of course, why the apple and the tree? What is the main idea that you want to convey to the readers when you wrote this book?
Well, actually, it was all a coming together of circumstances. I had done a creative writing course, an MA in creative writing, so I really, really wanted to do something with it and write a book. And I came back with no publisher, no agent, no nothing. But I kept on writing just to practice. And of course, you know, you always have to write what you know, and I know my family really well. So I was writing bits and pieces about things I remembered from my childhood, that sort of thing. And by chance, about a year ago, last October, Penguin approached me and said, would you like to write a book for us? And we'd like a book about being the daughter of Tun M. And I thought, oh, okay, great, you know, of all people, Penguin is asking me to do a book. And it's a subject that I obviously know, and it's a topic that lots and lots of people ask me about. So I started writing it, and it helped that I had little bits and pieces already. So it was a matter of, you know, expanding on what I had. And they gave me a very short deadline anyway. So that's how it came about.
It does come across as a collection of stories or a compendium of stories. And the way I find this book interesting is because it snapshots different aspects of the time, the timeline,
right,
between you and your father. And I felt that that is a bit of how we understand Tun M as well. There's always bits and pieces of how we feel that he's always there perpetually. But at the same time, there are periods where he came into our lives a little bit more significant than other times.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, the difference that I want to highlight is that we see Tun M as the father figure, the patriarch figure of the country. I certainly view him as such. You know, I'm 1980s throughout my life, and I'm sure you've heard this so many times. But yes, you know, that is the only leader I know. And then, of course, when Tun M stepped aside in 2003, then we have all these machinations going on. It didn't come across to me, not once, that he is still a father, that he's still a grandfather, mm-hmm, that you lost him because of us,
mm-hmm,
that you felt that you got him back in 2003 and lost him again in a way.
Yeah.
It opened a new window for me. That's why I really want to talk to you about that. Do you feel that that is something that you are cognizant of, that 35 million Malaysians really don't see him as a father? They see him more as a leader?
Well, of course. I mean, because most of them know him from the papers, know him from, you know, projects like that and various things. So he's very much larger than life for most people. But for me, of course, it's different. It's almost like having two people. there in the family, one is the father, one is the prime minister, and sometimes it's hard to separate the two. But sometimes, you know, we relate to him just as a father, of course, and, you know, as we grow up and various points in anybody's life, right, when you're going to get married or go on to university, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I really wanted to kind of bring it down to a much more personal level, because I know that's what most people wouldn't know. And like I said, the number one favorite question people ask me is, what is it like to be Dr. M's daughter? Mm-hmm. So I was trying to explain that, mm-hmm. you know, how it affected me mm-hmm. In my everyday life, in growing up, how it informed my values and everything.
The main character of this book, pardon me, is neither you nor your father. It's neither the apple nor the tree, but the ground that it stays on, which is Tun Hasma.
That's a very good way of putting it.
Every single scene that you portray, it's like, oh, so drama is here and the drama is there. And, you know, or political leaders come in or something. There's always Tun Hasma in the background.
Yep.
And that is something that is consistent with all Malaysians. We've always known Tun Hasma as the rock. And if I can quote you, it is total. The loyalty is total.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody will disagree on that single statement that you put.
Yeah. I only wrote one chapter really dedicated to her. And I kind of wish I could have written more. In fact, after I submitted the manuscript, I thought, I could have put that in, because she does have her own views on many things, and she does, you know, make it known. Like, for instance, she participated in that Wanita Against Toxic Politics march that we had. Mm-hmm. And there she was, you know, I think she was 90 or 91, standing on the truck, you know, and making this speech. And I've never felt so proud of her as when she did that, you know. So she has all these sides to her, which I don't think I really gave a chance to explore, because I was more focused on my dad and I relationship. Mm. But
she keeps on resurfacing.
She does. She's always there, of course. Yeah. She's very much part of him. I mean, those two are, what do you call it? You know, peas in a pod or whatever.
Bonnie and Clyde, I would call it.
Bonnie and Clyde? Oh, those are criminals. Another couple I can think of that would fit that.
But that's the tone that I find it quite interesting. It was it's pleasurable reading, and I find that I could finish the book in 1.5 days. Of course, I have to admit, it's because of homework as well, because of the interview that I'm going to have with you. But generally speaking, this is a good book, and I find that it's quite interesting. We'll go for one short break. When we come back, we'll discuss a little bit more with Datin Paduka Marina Mahade on the book, The Apple and the Tree. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back. I have with me Datin Paduka Marina Mahade, the author of The Apple and the Tree. This is your first, of course, book publishing?
Well, not quite. I mean, this is technically the fifth, but the rest were all compilations of my column or blog posts. This is the first one that I've written from start to finish.
And of course, the scintillating details are quite magnificent. The reason I say that is because you capture the essence of the moment. You are not transcribing the events.
Right.
Those are two different things.
Yes.
I look at things the way it is transcribed. Uh-huh. This guy enters the thing, spoke about this. This lady leaves the room with a bunch of this. The way you put things is actually quite much, much more emotional, much, much more dramatic. The guy's had a worrisome face. The smile was evaporated the moment I asked the lady this question. Mm. It's so fresh, the take.
Oh,
of course, towards the end of the book, you talked about the resignation and what's next. And I think that maybe you could share your part of the event on those kind of events, really, really meaningful events. I don't want to be the spoiler of the book, but generally speaking, but yeah, the kind of this mega events that
last week of
yeah, why not?
Pakatan. Well, you know, it was so dramatic, right? And it was also very confusing for everyone. And I happened to be there, so I thought I would just record, kind of like fly on the wall almost, you know, what was happening, because I was actually there at the house, and I was involved in some of the meetings, and I just pretty much just inserted myself there as an observer. Mm. I even put my phone there to record things, and nobody objected. So okay, lah, you know.
It's a carnival, right? At that point in time, it was. Like
yeah,
like
you know,
circus.
I was going back and forth and back and forth, and like who's got the numbers, who's going to be there, and things like that. So there was a lot of, I guess, it was quite chaotic. I don't think anyone really expected, you know, the things to go that way. I think my dad at that point thought that, okay, I'll step down and then the next person will just take over. We have the numbers anyway, wouldn't matter so much and all that. But then, you know, people walked out and then changed the numbers and then everything changed, right? And I remember that feeling as an ordinary person, how like, who on earth is leading this country right now, you know, for that whole week? There wasn't anyone and all these machinations going on. And then, you know, some of the Pakatan leaders, you know, asked me to arrange. You know, my dad sort of said, okay, I'm out. You know, you guys don't want me. I'm out. And then they said, can we talk to him again and all that? And I called him up and I said, you know, Mr. Lim would like to talk to you, Kit Siang Lim the Elder. And he said, what about? You know, it's done, you know. And he said, no, they want to talk to you. That's the message I'm supposed to convey.
Don't shoot the messenger.
You know, so I said, ah, okay lah. So it didn't happen that night for various reasons, and just happened the next night, and it was quite extraordinary for me to actually witness, you know, the dynamics of, you know, all these people trying to persuade him to come back, and he was, you know, it took a long time to convince him, because he felt like, you know, we don't have the numbers.
That's the part, right? You've been a fly on the wall, so to speak, on many of these events that has shaped the country over the past, I don't know, five, six decades?
Not a lot, I have to say.
And why is that? Why recently then? Why towards the second coming?
Because I was quite involved by accident, I have to say, with the 2018 campaign, the GA14 campaign. I'm not in any political party, so I'm usually the last person to know what's going on. But, you know, because we decided to film the whole campaign, Dian and I. So I had to be there when they had their presidential council meetings. I had to go around saying, don't mind the cameras, okay? Mm. And that was when Guan Eng asked me to come and speak at the rally in Penang. And then once he said that, the floodgates seemed to be open, like everyone else started asking me. And so I went, I thought, okay, this is my little bit, you know, to help. And that's how I sort of became closer. And, you know, it's the first time really that all these guys I knew in the opposition side and, you know, NGOs and all that, and my dad were suddenly aligned. And it was a very almost surreal experience, but a great experience. I mean, it was a great feeling. It was whole David versus Goliath battle, you know, and we never thought that we would win. We just go in and do the best and just fight, you know. So I felt very much that I had a right to be there at the end, you know, because I was kind of there at the beginning, and And all the drama, I mean, there was so much drama.
Yeah, not enough for this interview to cover, I know.
No.
But the story that I would also want to ask you is that, how do you want to be seen, being upfront, the close observer, the person that is recording all this? Do you feel that you have an obligation to tell the people what it's like truly to be a regular Malaysian, a non-political party person, to be telling the story of politics? Because as it stands right now, politicians do rank poorly.
Yeah.
Perhaps the poorest,
yeah,
in terms of occupations out there. It was never high in the first place, mm-hmm, but now it's like in the negative territory perhaps.
Yeah.
Well, but at the same time, a person like me, I cover tech, I cover business, I cover commercial issues, I cover economics. None of them works unless the political system actually functions and functions well.
Yeah.
So how do you feel that kind of obligation? Do you feel that there's something bigger that you have to deliver here, to reinstate back the faith that one must have in the political system?
I don't know about the political system on the whole. I mean, the political system obviously is in need of great reform and change before people can trust it again, right? But I just felt privileged to have been there. And to me, I was recording it as a writer, you know, not as a daughter or anything like that. Mm. I mean, I was trained as a journalist to begin with, and I just felt like, you know, these are moments in our history that need to be recorded and need to be talked about, and nobody else was really there. Of course, the people who participated were there, and so far, none of them have disputed my account of it. Mm. So I just felt that...
Well, some of them are quite difficult to dispute because it's like, you know, it's personal interaction. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, of course, the things are in public domain, yeah, of course. But,
yeah.
But we have to take your word for it.
Some people read a little bit and then extrapolated about the whole book from that.
Yeah.
And if you read it, you know that's not the way it is.
Yeah,
but
exactly, yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there like, I'm going to tell the truth of everything. I don't know.
It doesn't feel like it. It feels like you are just a fly on the wall.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, a good reporter, a good writer, that's what we should do. You know, we report things as they are. And, you know, people can interpret it as they want, I think.
Okay. Of which, we're running out of time, unfortunately. But of which, what would be some of the two or three things that you want people to actually get out of this book? Your personal wish. Of course, people can interpret the things they want, but generally speaking, what do you want people to learn from this?
Number one, that I'm a good writer.
You are. You are. And I read up to, and I'm not boasting or I'm not trying, but I do read up to 30 books a year, despite my busy schedule. This is right up there, Marina.
Thank you.
I'm not even kidding.
Thank you.
Not because of the factual items or whatever, it's that whole emotive argument. I normally just read non-fiction, and of course this is right up there when it comes to storytelling.
It's called creative non-fiction, which is what I did my MA
creative
in.
Creative non-fiction.
Yeah, or literary non-fiction. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, but yes, sorry.
What would I... Well, I... Number one, don't judge a book by its cover, which I felt like a lot of people did. Secondly, I think that everything, there's a nuance to everything. I think we've gotten to a stage where we're so mistrustful of everything, of, you know, that...
But you blame them.
No, I don't blame them.
Yeah, exactly.
Honestly, I don't blame them. I mean, I listened to Maria Ressa's speech at the Nobel.
That's brilliant, oh my
wasn't
God.
Wasn't it? Wasn't it? And she was talking about, like, you know, you need facts to get to the truth.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you need truth to have trust, right? And that's what we are also suffering from. Like, we don't know what's real, what's, you know, and what are the facts and all that. So I hope to just provide a little contribution to the facts, you know, and if anyone else has to add factually, then great. And I hope that we get to a point where we can rebuild trust again. But, you know, as she says, we need to know more of what is the truth instead of the stuff that we get, you know, we get given all the time.
But, you know, how do I put this? Let's leave the politics aside and look at the pandemic, we all have the same access of information, we all have the same access of facts, yet our conclusions vary wildly. You have anti-vaxxers, you have people that disapprove of the booster shots, you have so many opinions out there.
Yeah.
And they're all quoting or citing the same facts and sources. It's so bizarre that just because facts are out there, you don't necessarily come to the same conclusion, even though the conclusions that needed to be arrived at is actually quite obvious.
Well, I don't know whether people all have access to the same facts, really. And I think that's the problem, that there's so much disinformation, misinformation. And, you know, everyone, you know, goes to the University of WhatsApp now. Everyone's a doctor now, based from the University of WhatsApp. And, you know, I think we need to be mindful of that, you know.
My mother's a professor. Skeptical. My mother's a professor of University of WhatsApp. Every day she... Unbelievable. Okay. Thank you very much again.
Thank you for having me.
Is there more? The ground where the apple... I'm giving you a title here. The ground where the apple sits or stands. How about that?
We'll see. And then
we'll have a little bit more about Tun Hasma.
Inshallah.
Yeah?
Thank you.
All right. The Apple and the Tree. Out in major bookstores. Of course, you can get this. I don't know. Is there an ebook version of this as well?
There's supposed to be, and hopefully also an audiobook.
Fantastic.
And a Malay version.
So who's going to narrate the audiobook?
Me, I hope.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, there you have it. So if you want to learn more, major bookstores everywhere around the country, The Apple and the Tree is out right now. Till then, thanks very much for watching and goodbye.